start by reading a little biography about Brigitte. Can everybody hear me okay?
Closer?
Yeah. Okay, great. Brigitte Sharma is an associate professor of creative writing at the University of Montana. She is the author of Bliss to Fill, The Opening Question, and Infamous Landscapes. Her forthcoming collection of poems, Under Gloom, will be published in 2013. She is the recipient of the 2010 Howard Foundation Fellowship. For 2012, she has been awarded artist residencies at Hotel Pupik in Austria, Headland Center for the Arts in California, and the Malay Colony in New York. I remember the first time Brigitte called me on my cell phone. It was exactly around this time of year in spring, March 2011. When I answered, I heard a voice on the other end of the line that said something like, "Hi, this is Brigitte Sharma, director of the creative writing program here at the University of Montana. I'd like to inform you that you've been accepted to the MFA program." Swooned from the news and news that had been delivered by Brigitte herself, I stupidly said something like, "Wow, how cool." Before that phone call, and a couple of months earlier when I was applying to graduate school, my mentor Catherine Coles had told me, "Brigitte's pretty rad, you'll like her." Poet Andre Yang, my cousin, also told me excitedly about how much he adored Brigitte. He said, "She's cool, man, she's got ties with Kundiman." And then, in mid-August 2011, when I met her in person, accidentally, in search for Nathan Irizarry to turn in paperwork, I was struck even further by her charm and energy. My partner James had been with me while we perused through the LA building, and when we came across Brigitte's office, it was only 8 or 9 minutes into the conversation of, "Hellos, nice to finally meet you in person. How do you like Missoula? This is James. He's a computer engineer and in search for a job," that Brigitte insisted on walking both James and I down to the IT center located in the building to help James get a job. Brigitte was indeed rad. When I got a hold of her books to read before fall semester began, I experienced a side of Brigitte that hadn't been like the Brigitte I had met in person. Brigitte's poetry explores a hardness of life, the tender binaries of race and culture, and an aloneness that one moves through towards something outside itself. I remember thinking, "Wow, she's a hard poet." As Peter Gizzi comments, the subject of Brigitte's poems is most often expression itself in its unexpected terms, the way intimacy can be extended by interruption and digression, pushing toward a knowledge of what it is to be awake and vulnerable in the ancient 21st century. For me, Brigitte's poems fill a new darkness, luring one in as a firefly admits to light. And in the madness of this ancient 21st century, she writes, "We are hidden by our evolution. We are strangers. We are, in some ways, living undemonstrated amidst our expressions and demonstrations." In her poetry, a reader falls victim to lounge where the foreground meets the background, to think aloud, "I haven't lost myself and I haven't lived like this before." That is, one is perpetually driven to search for the magic in words that are romantic, scientific, and reactionary. A reader must not only watch, observe, and listen with concern, but that reader must also relocate. Heed to the warning, "Be careful of poems, for they follow you." Because, reader or writer, poems in many ways invent you 20 times over. In the way that poetry becomes natural and yet incessantly unnatural for the performer, the anxiety that swells in her poetry alerts us to prepare for the leaps between shifting landscapes, landscapes that reteach shadows and loneness, truth and plainness. As in Bliss to Fill, Brigitte writes, "The heritage of being alone is to transmit truth to yourself faithfully, to still the paradigm of what opposes you in the world." And in the peaks of infamous landscapes, we are struck again with a voice of grace and composure, alone and lopsided. Spending a semester with Brigitte in a poetry workshop was not only a greater privilege for me while working among other poets and colleagues, but because of Brigitte's passion and enthusiasm for poetry and learning, I was able to experience a supportive community of writers. Of course, meeting individually at Break Espresso to discuss poetry and dining out a couple of times as a group to talk more about poetry only made that privilege even more special. It's truly been wonderful getting to know Brigitte as a person, poet, and professor. Would everyone please welcome Brigitte Sharma.
Kathy. And thank you, Sean. And thank you, Second Wind. Thank you, Top Hat. I'm going to read poems. Wait, how's that? Can you hear me? Okay. I'm going to read poems from my new manuscript, Under Gloom. And the title is from the Iliad, Fitzgerald, Crowded Souls, Brave to the Undergloom. The sort of three themes of the book are I like thinking about, as I have in other books, romantic poetry, the lyric. I'm also thinking about canonical work, I think because we're all teaching canonical work, and especially at the undergraduate level, we're always sort of teaching the kind of authority that the poem has. But I sort of want to dismantle the authority and play with some lines a little bit. The second is, I am thinking about the abject self, the speaker. But I realized, actually, Josh and I have always been talking about the abject, and I realized that the poems themselves aren't necessarily abject spaces, that the speaker is speaking out of abjection, but trying to have maybe some integrity. So I realize that it's not always evident in the poem, but it is evident in thinking about the speaker. And three, also to think about the natural world and the West and the way in which one thinks about landscape, how it's sort of historically written as beatific, but I try to talk more about how we stage the poem. And how we write about the natural world as ornamental and decorative, and maybe we can talk about race and otherness through that. Now this poem, first poem, is Poem for Lee Hunt. I find ways to keep a sense of peace, but it is not always easy. For example, I can't keep my questions tempered. What kind of sun expands its rays upon the hills, but then mutes like an ordinary bulb, small and self-contained? Moreover, what moon filters the blistering whiteness of snow so that it can only be seen by the fiscally immune, enamored by the dully noted? Let me amble with Keats and his wandering expression and try to figure out if the poem keeps me encased in the rapture for which my dim external life won't account. And I have a line from Wallace Stevens. It is the word pejorative that hurts. And the title of this poem is In Our Shared Rage. The clouds come over us. We trouble with the pallor of our mottled selves because our bodies are stuffed with filigree and our minds with dots. We put junk into both in order to play with ornamentation, to table psyches with expensive trash. Yet strangely, we feel liberated. When we speak with fonts that interrupt each other with a size and shape and fury of flight that undoes the obedient decency of our characters. Then words dismount, becoming fables, interrupting Byzantine spaces, ones variously garnished with parenthetical size. We, like these words, have misguided and stylized largeness, and thus we feel ourselves to be instruments quaking in turbulence. The outcry can momentarily harm the sphere of dialogue, breaking the rhetorical semblances with cultural interjections. This language has accrued around us, and thus we try these words on. Sometimes there's pain. But we don't disparage this truth and see it as erasure. Hearts sing in troubled times, still salvageable to the ear, something that is not the lyric, but a hoarse cough. The ear does need a muscle, a drown, dawn side face, a little village to pillage away from sight, a pardon from word sounds, because there are too many turns with logic and reason. We noticed too many seated discuss our value, and we turn away from others with a disgust we discarded, that we put down. Our paltry payment of blood is for the foolhardy who find our faces menacing, discussing them the way one discusses fucking and copulation. Are these disgusting words, or is it a word that propels us to what comes after rage? Then there is a newness in the feelings. There's aftermath in language, now drowning in its consequence. It's the leveling steel presence that somehow blinks and blinks. This is a poem. I think I'm sort of, I still am sort of repulsed and repelled and mesmerized by the idea that we in institutions make art. It seems like it's just a strange tension to make art in institutions. It seems like you step into a very inorganic space, and then you encourage everyone to make art in that space. So I wanted to think about figurative language as artificial and have fun with that. Wildlife. A fostering of spirit and humanity dissolved. The tiny web turned verbs into ammunition. A jostling of hung words unfurling down. This is the institution where poets are demonstrably immersed in their craft. This is the attainable self-performance where need carries need. Silky selves rife with a palpable overwhelm. Initially, there were words found from a pellet gun dipped in pathetic fallacy, a kind of crafting of material righteousness, but beneath were inchoate selves, searching for advancement through the alignment with the natural world. Words formed images from the insistence of seeing canyons, ranges, and valleys. Words formed particular insights into how, within these landscapes, birds and animals are seen. For example, the flammulated owl, mountain plover, or blue sucker emerge and confront the poet seeing. These vantage points stocked with animals and birds induce a kind of human throb, one that begets knowing how to see more deeply, a rich felt sensation. But what is seen in the poem about the natural world? Perhaps there is a perception of some inscrutable invocation by a poet with whom attributes under the scarlet sun unearth the stardom of a creature of being, a form of other, sanctioned. Who knew that in finding formulas one would awaken the insatiability of the mouth eating its words? The sheer velocity of certain kinds of poems with their Orphic will turning you into nothing, a poet as humbler reader of occasion. Or you will find bullets and you will fire these words into the air. What should I say to the kind of illicit behavior of twindom turning to mob, of animals behaving like humans, little sheep turn into diamond star wolves at the promise of both drink and their art meaning something determined. Well, let's say overdetermined. A sharpshooter's mission to free fall. The noiseless spider ate his own impure poem, long legs breaking with need and attention under the encumbered weight of snow. I also try to have some humor. There's some there. Pan-American. I should have been studying policies, but I felt shy about my knees. I was knock-kneed, and it spread to my decision-making. Every thought was abnormally close to the last one. I became the person who bought merchandise that no one would buy in order to be part of the job share. The products were maltreated by the popular ones. There is a nice mock-heroic stance in here. It's that I don't know any other way, and thus I can inadvertently become a member of the mobilizing force, a dynasty for which it is good to sway and bend. This one, I was thinking about characters, and I was thinking about the way a lot of modern and contemporary Indian poetry looks, where if it's written in English or it's translated by the poet into English, it has a sort of narrative quality that I think these poets like Adil Jusawala, Sunithi Namjoshi, and Kamala Das, I sort of grew up looking at their narratives, and they seem to all engage with a narrative that classified the feelings and ethical virtues of their characters. And so I was sort of thinking about the virtue of kind of a pompous poet. I wanted to sort of create it and have this narrative to it, and think about what that shape would look like for this sort of ego identity. Glenda glistens. Glenda glistens with a peptic sour formed from hollow gladiolas and wrench-shaped lilacs. Why did they come for her? It's because nobody for miles can outperform her in self-mythologizing. Lord Krishna himself fails. He burdens the metaphor with his ungainly blueness. But can anyone see the scale of her platitudes capsizing, especially in foreign hands? She can't be left alone like this, without her harp, without her thistle, without her myrtle tree's ignitions. I fathom she will say that life's real heart world is too rich in hue to be made into a trope. She will have to transform yet another corpse's dander and spin life's poisons and spells into poetry's capricious acquisitions. But that's sort of there's a funny, kind of lofty narrative in some of these poems. Kamala Das comes to mind. My most beloved comrade took her leave. What if I told you that I lived in a sphere where there was too much scrutiny? When that ended, there was silence. And when that ended, conflict became strife. What was my weary task, I asked myself? Who here was the mother of heroes? Valor and worth credible, of course, but in this remote city, quite like a town, I couldn't find anything but a forgotten helmet along the bike path. When she left, it was sad and I was so gloomy, but she left me a javelin which I threw quite far, landing me a cowardice lion who taught me that there is indeed tenderness underneath and that to find it, I had to undress my spirit of its purple scents. Fool's purpose. For months, there were terrible mannequins hanging around. I thought they were students missing words, words they couldn't have. But this wasn't the case. They had them. They hid them. They even held on to them when their clothes fell off. The stupor was a mystery. Some of the language, the want to speak, went south into the undergloom. It was where six of the words had gone. They were my words, but they hadn't shown much promise, or at least that was how it felt. I thought my colleagues had them, but they too had been missing words, words that held important wayward thoughts, maybe misanthropic, disheartened, but mainly those confused ones, salvageable, but no, too inappropriate. And you couldn't have those in the classroom, so all fled. But I had wanted to keep them, and I forgot to write a memo. I wanted those words that hung to the undergloom, stuck to the ferns, the melodrama, the drop of blue with the hint of green. They fled. They couldn't be seen from this side. Maybe a mission for the pauper. I had become the pauper. It was either the pauper or the piper. I had been both. No music to lure, no brand new words. I was the only one to say it was there, that it was part of the show. I had to sell the show to get our narrative back. And who am I to say this was all collective? This is sheer arrogance. The words with their decorum are still unknown to me. I was going to have to go to the river. I was going to have to learn to swim. Will you let go for ransom? No. And so deep was the fall, what a drop. I had nicks on my knuckles. There is a passage of time for all of it to hold you. Then you hold it. You wring it by its neck. It's murderous and invisible, a darkling spot that grips. And on some days, we would head to the bar in the middle of the river. The wail or the cries there found us. Some colleagues had tears down each eye. Some other colleagues made them cry. We tried handing them words, but it all became inaccurate fast. I held my purse in my fist, not sure if this was a place I could get mugged, but I was reminded that it wasn't. I was still unsure. I told you we are all like fish, happenstance troubled, out to the river and to the undergloom. And glad I am, I took you in and pushed all of the urchins out and off the deck. I didn't have to tie you. You tied me with several words, several serious words. Two more poems. I was also thinking Marian Moore and her quirky authority. So this is after Marian Moore. People absolve themselves and eat their young. The white light is hanging above the mountains. Below, it dusts us with cool air. I'm holding on to the notion that I belong here, despite how it feels when I let go of my thoughts and travel through my body. And it feels all animal, all a simple negation of belonging. In the Katha Upanishads, quote, the horses, they say, are your senses. But in the West, there are horses, and then there are horses. And to emote is to be defensive, but one can be defensive if you have the right to defend. There is an ownership to the horse and how its identity moves with you. This is your horse sense. I tell people that I've been to Bozeman and I've met Turner's Arabians. What does this now say about me? I'm too fancy to understand plain horses. Who are critics and who are believers? Are they one? Do they force a tide? Do they string a fence? Do they find similes where there are none? This idea that your community communes is one I find specious. This meaning is not fully delivered to me. I'd rather stay out of it and tell you how Behrman sees it. It kissed us soft to cut our throats, this coast. I stopped reaching for live poets to guide, nor do I find their horses. I find dead ones who, in their idiosyncratic ways, return not to the horse, but to their broken but functional feeders, their sturdy hay, their world in general, no matter how fast it's moving or how indolent it is of its growing shadow. I'm going to go back to Keats, my last poem here. Actually, I do have to say one thing, you know, about Keats, and I think you know about Violets and Keats and his grave. We buried our cat in our front yard, and as soon as spring hit, all these beautiful violets grew right in the little space of the grave. The widget board in the earth. In this sense, my computer is my harvest, and it sets up a dugout for my beleaguered egotism. What I'd rather do instead of hunker down in this no man's land is shine forth brilliantly. If I could, the effusive style will allow me to franchise all concrete discourse that eludes me like a widget board through which Keats is engaged a feeling for an old couch of space. This would leave me not bereft of any invisible furniture, nor a surplus of concussed feelings. I could have a spiritual guide to the checkered violets growing an overture over our black porch grave and in our candy house full of moles. Thank you.